This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The New York Times describes North Carolina's penal system as one of the most racially biased in the country. A 2009 law sought to address racial prejudice in death row cases. It was called the Racial Justice Act, but it was repealed 4 years later when Republicans gained power in the state of North Carolina. Now, the North Carolina State Supreme Court is looking at 6 death penalty cases. 4 of those cases got a second look under the Racial Justice Act and were indeed found to have been tainted by racial bias. Their sentences were changed to life in prison without parole. But those 4 people were put back on death row when the Racial Justice Act was repealed. State Senator Floyd McKissick Jr. sponsored the Racial Justice Act that got passed in 2009. He is senior deputy Democratic leader in the Senate, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome back, Senator McKissick.
Thank you. It's nice to be back here.
Tell us what the Racial Justice Act did.
Well, what it sought to do is simply say that in these capital cases involving the death penalty, that if race was used as a significant factor in the prosecutor's decision to seek the death penalty or in the jury's decision to impose the death penalty, it allowed those on death row at that time up to 1 year to file a claim for consideration. And in fact, I think we had over 130 people on death row at that time. Seek relief underneath the Racial Justice Act.
And if their claim was verified, tell us what happened. They don't get out of jail.
No. And if their claim was verified, if it was substantiated after lengthy court hearings, and of course the hearings where the 4 defendants were successful in obtaining relief, it wasn't a get-out-of-jail-for-free card. It basically said that their sentence was changed. It was that they would remain in jail for life without the possibility of parole. And that was it. I mean, that was the relief that was granted. Some people might have argued that it didn't go far enough, that what they deserved was a new trial. But in considering what we could get through the General Assembly, and we had people supporting the death penalty, as well as those that were opposed to the death penalty, come together to support the Racial Justice Act because they understood that no one should be on death row because race was or prejudice was a consideration in the prosecutor's decision to seek the death penalty or the jury's decision to impose it.
And this was not just an arbitrary look at our penal system. In fact, there was a great deal of research to suggest that racism and race does play a part. Tell us about the research.
Sure. I mean, the research was done. In fact, it was a significant University of Michigan study that looked over basically a 20-year window of time, and I think they looked at a total of over 173 cases and found that there was substantial bias, particularly when it came to striking qualified African-American jurors from serving on juries. And that was something I think that we were very much concerned about. I mean, what you found is that prosecutors in North Carolina were striking African-American jurors at a rate that was about 2.5 to 3 times greater than what it was for white jurors.
Yeah, and this New York Times editorial that I've just quoted at the beginning of our segment here, quotes some of the prosecutors and judges and jurors in those cases, and it is pretty clear what was going on, at least in many, many cases in this state, I'm sure elsewhere as well.
Yeah, and it was absolutely egregious. And one thing that I think also needs to come into this conversation is that so often prosecutors in deciding whether to seek the death penalty, it was a black-on-black crime, they didn't seek it. It was a white-on-white crime, they didn't seek it. But if for some reason the victim was white and the alleged assailant was black, that so often is also when they sought the death penalty.
But look, in these cases, again, you're talking about statistics. So let's talk about that, the way in which statistics could be used. In other words, what evidence would I need to bring to this hearing once I have applied for relief? Just because we know that racism is everywhere. We're living in a society that is based on a foundation of white supremacy. So it's going to be everywhere. What do I have to do in court to demonstrate that my case became a capital case because of my race?
Well, it was not only something that was driven by statistics, because there was a lot of data out there, and you could lay it on a statewide basis, on a judicial district or prosecutorial level basis. But more importantly, they looked at the facts of each individual case. And what they found were notes that had to be produced in discovery from prosecutors that simply would show in some instances that somebody who was black was not going to be qualified to serve, basically because of their race. And they go through all types of marginal notes as to why this particular black should be excluded from a jury. And it happened in almost all of these cases.
Now, it's my understanding of the system that both the defense and the prosecutor have a right to strike X number of potential jurors for any reason they want. They don't even have to give a reason. Am I right about that?
They do have preemptory challenges, but it can't be based upon race. And United States Supreme Court has said that. And in fact, a case called Batson established kind of the ground rules for that. But in 1995, the Conference of District Attorneys actually had a training manual which prosecutors could use with explanations that were standard form explanations that you could use as a prefabricated excuse for getting somebody excused if someone challenged that it was due to race. So they could come back and say, oh, no, it wasn't due to race. It was based upon their dress or their tattoos or other types of things that might serve as a predicate that might be legally permissible. But you had 10 different things that were put into a prosecutor's manual to say, look, if you got challenged on race, use one of these prefabricated excuses and you'll get off.
So, and you're talking about cases, too, where the notes were clear. They didn't even bother to use those cases. It was very clear that race was the reason, and that's not legal. So let's talk about at least four of the six cases that are now before the Supreme Court. Tell us about what the state Supreme Court, what is it that the state Supreme Court is considering right now?
Well, at this point in time, what you understand is that the Racial Justice Act was passed in 2009. It was repealed in 2013. In the interim years, four of these people got relief underneath the Racial Justice Act, and their sentences were changed to life in jail in prison without the possibility of parole. For those particular individuals, those decisions were challenged by prosecutors. Prosecutors said they didn't have enough time to prepare for those cases. So the North Carolina Supreme Court previously sent the case back down to be considered in Cumberland County by Superior Court judges to say, hey, you know, you need to go back and rethink or rehear these cases. In the interim, the law was repealed, so the decision made was to dismiss those cases. The dismissal of those cases and whether it was valid to dismiss those cases is now up before the North Carolina Supreme Court. It is contended, and I support these contentions, that if that law was on the books, if people sought relief in that period, if they obtained relief in that period, that the cases should not have been dismissed later on because they had a constitutional right to have their cases heard.
Yeah, let me
see. And their claims heard.
Yeah, because here's a case where they've gone through a process and there has been a decision that, in fact, race played a part in the decision to give you the death penalty. Therefore, we're changing your sentence to life without parole. And now you're back on death row because the law that allowed for that process has been repealed.
And there's no precedent for that, to go back and put somebody on death row without having any type of rehearing or any reconsideration. And in fact, these people had claims that were valid at that point in time. So the dismissal of those charges, dismissal of the relief obtained underneath the Racial Justice Act is what the North Carolina Supreme Court will be considering. And I hope and trust that when they review the evidence and they look at the totality of what has occurred and the egregiousness also of the conduct that these prosecutors engaged in, if they look at the full history of the case and not just the procedural aspects of the case, that they would decide that these claims were filed in a timely way and that they deserve to be entitled to the relief that the Racial Justice Act provided.
You had this act in place. There were cases, as you say, where on further review, it was clear that race played a part. That's on the books. We understand that now in this number of cases in a very, very short period of time that the law was in effect. And then the law is repealed. Why was it repealed?
Well, it was repealed basically, in my mind, because the Republican majority at that point in time was not sensitive to what this bill sought to remedy. What it really sought to remedy is to stop prosecutors in this state from impermissibly using race as a significant factor in these death penalty cases. That ought to be something that's uncontested. It's about a fair criminal justice system, free of prejudice, free of bias, free of discrimination. And if what you found and what they found here was a mountain of evidence What we should be doing is making certain that all the claims that were filed in that period are actually heard and appropriately decided, and provide that framework, that structure, to so that prosecutors understand in the future, this is not where you can go in North Carolina. It's illegal. It's impermissible. And your conduct as a prosecutor should be judged accordingly if you use race in an inappropriate way in these cases.
And a lot that has changed. I mean, the fact is that while the process has gone forward and we understand that it is in many ways now, and our understanding is growing and how unfair the process is and how stacked it is, there's so much more evidence now that maybe that's one of the reasons why it might be fair to review all these cases. But what about the argument that, look, there's just too many cases. Our court system is overloaded now, and you're asking us to go back over these complicated cases. You're asking too much.
Well, first of all, it's not too much if death is the ultimate penalty that's being debated here. Taking someone's life, particularly in a day, in a time, in an era where you find people on death row all across America who are being exonerated as a result of new DNA evidence, which is being found, or other changes in the collection of evidence that allows a person to be exonerated. And in many cases, there are people being exonerated of all types of crimes, including those involving murders. And that's why many of these people are on death row. Now, that can't be the excuse. Justice cannot be denied because of the volume of cases that might be potentially heard. The thing which I would point out is that each case would be decided individually. So each case would be looked at on its individual merits. If there was additional compelling, substantial evidence that substantiated these claims of racial bias, then judges would be empowered to the relief provided under the Racial Justice Act. Not every case is going to meet that standard. There are probably some that do. There are probably others that don't. But what we do know is that there was profound and substantial evidence. And if you look at the decision that was rendered by Judge Weeks in the cases that were decided in Cumberland County, there's 200 pages. 200 pages of facts and statistics and findings that supported his decision. It wasn't casually made. It wasn't made based upon an emotional appeal. It was based upon data, data that was profound and significant, that was deserving of the outcome.
If the Supreme Court decides that these cases should be reheard, and if the defendant or those on death row should prevail, what, again, this is four cases out of many that have been requested. What do you think would be the impact? Would there be any momentum? Obviously, Republicans still control the legislature. They don't control the governor's mansion, and they've lost some of the power they've had in both chambers. Could this build momentum for a reintroduction of a Racial Justice Act?
I would certainly hope that it would. I would hope that there'd be compelling reasons to see that there was a need for it when it existed, that its repeal was inappropriate and untimely, but more importantly, that our criminal justice system has to be free of racial bias and prejudice. And this bill only dealt with those cases involving capital punishment. It wasn't a pervasive remedy for other cases. And when we talk about rehearing things, we're not talking about having new trials on these cases. We're only looking at whether race was a significant factor in the prosecutor's decision to seek or the jury's decision to impose the death penalty, including the striking of qualified African-American jurors from serving on juries so that, you know, perhaps, you know, these people didn't get the type of trial that they deserve from the very outset.
Right. But as you say, it's not the trial, it's not the procedure, it's not the facts in this case. It's simply the application of death penalty, the decision to do that, and how that procedure went forward. So that does raise the larger question. We know, this, as you talk about, the substantial data in these cases, the substantial research that shows how unequal and unjust our penal system is. What do we do to address that? Is the state legislature looking at ways to address some of these root fundamental injustices?
I think it's important to do so. And yes, I think that there's a lot of discussion today about criminal justice reform, and there's lots of work that's being done in that area. I've done a lot of work in recent years dealing with expunctions. Now, when people say, what is expunctions? When you erase a criminal history from somebody who might have been involved in offense, including people who had charges dismissed. I mean, I had a bill 4 years ago that went back and said, it created the first vehicle for automatic expunctions in our case, in our state, for cases of mistaken of identity and identity fraud. So if someone stole your identity, went out there, committed criminal offenses, and you got charged, and later the charges were dismissed, why do you deserve to have a criminal history?
Are you saying that's not automatic?
It only became automatic because of a bill that I passed 4 years ago.
Well, I didn't realize it took an act of the legislature to get that
It
changed.
Took an act of legislature, and we were the first states in America that was able to accomplish that. But even today, if you were charged with an offense that's not subject to the automatic expunction provisions that exist today for mistaken identity and identity fraud, you would have to go in and apply and hire an attorney and go through a lengthy process to obtain an expunction of charges that are dismissed or where you're found not guilty based upon a law that I filed this year, and it has gotten bipartisan support, called the Second Chance Act. Over 150,000 to 200,000 people each year will begin in July 1, 2020, become available for automatic expunctions, which is important.
What are some of the other areas in our penal system do you think need attention right now, and what are some of your recommendations?
Sure. I think continuing the work that's being done, such as that under the Second Chance Act, looking at what we can do in terms of even people who have criminal histories and criminal records that are out there today. And I think we got to deal with the many individuals that have become just as involved, because that's important, in addition to looking at people that are pending in the system. So we have one challenge with cases that are currently pending, another set of people who have gone through the system and may have even paid their debts to society. They might have even paid restitution. They might have served time in jail. Those people can't go out and get jobs because of their criminal history. Those people can't go out and get apartments because of their criminal history. Those people might even be banned from getting certain student loans because of their criminal history. Coming up with ways for those people, after they paid their debt to society, to say, hey, you can get certain charges expunged. And this Second Chance Act goes as far as doing that for people involved in nonviolent misdemeanors and those who are not sexually orientated. So, I mean, you want to help those that have gone through the system, not just those that are in the pipeline today.
What about those in the pipeline today who will find themselves or may tomorrow? Bail reform is one of the things we're hearing most about. And again, the way that is unequally applied and the way it disproportionately affects people who don't have money. What about bail reform?
Bail reform is critical. And right now it's being addressed more on a local issue than on a local level than a statewide level, but they've done things in the District of Columbia. They've done things in the state of Pennsylvania as well as other jurisdictions.
Does it require state? What could you do at the state level?
At the state level, you could go in and rewrite our provisions under the law to basically state that you would not have cash money bonds unless they were of a certain level. Let's say, $5,000, $10,000, so that those people that are sitting in jail because they can't come up with $500, $700, $2,000 to get out because they can't afford a bondsman or they don't have the money, then they don't end up in jail and end up serving sentences in jail that might be for lengthy periods of time. In many of those instances of people that can't pay cash money bonds or get a bondsman, the charge that they are facing may only require 30 days of imprisonment,
right,
and they might spend 60 or 90 days for their trial.
And they might be not guilty.
And they may be not guilty. That's exactly right. All of the above.
Floyd McKissick Jr. Floyd McKissick Jr. is senior deputy Democratic leader in the North Carolina State Senate. He represents District 20 in Durham County. Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a privilege to be here.
Coming up on the State of Things, live music, Loamlands. Stay with us.